Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland performance of Soliloquists of Sound and Marv Ellis and We Tribe on Friday, February 9th at Mississippi Studios in Portland. This show is a co-headlined evening of psychedelic and funky conscious hip-hop from Florida and Portland. Their intention for this show is to help unify communities and to raise consciousness towards social and political issues here in the U.S. and around the world. Again, that's Soliloquists of Sound and Marv Ellis and We Tribe on Friday, February 9th at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a vision of Africa packaged for Western viewers. The films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include 76 and the Footprints of Pan-Africanism and more at the Hollywood Theater. And The African Who Wanted to Fly, Foreign Bodies, Wulu, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10:02. Coming up next is the Lit Fantastic, an all-new show here on KBOO. Tonight, they will be the Lit Fantastic will be talking to poet and editor John Tribble with a conversation about KFC, the cult of Colonel Sanders, and the blue-collar work.
This is The Lit Fantastic, a show about writers and their obsessions. I'm your host, Neil Aiken. We are excited to begin this season on radio. To our podcast listeners, a hearty welcome back. And to all of you in Radio Land, we'd like to welcome you to this show, which explores writers, their obsessions and fascinations that may or may not actually take place within the realms and the subjects that they actually engage in. Today, we talk to John Tribble, the editor of Crab Orchard Review and the author of two collections of poetry, Natural State, and There Is Many a Good Thing. His third book, God of the Kitchen, is forthcoming from Glasslyre Press later this year. In this conversation, we end up talking about the central obsession of this third book, his time spent as a teenager working for Kentucky Fried Chicken, the work of the kitchen, and the experiences in these type of blue-collar industries.
Over the last few years, I've gotten really focused on certain obsessions in writing based upon subject matter. And, of course, one of those has been I've been at work fairly seriously at work since about 2013, 2014 on a series of poems that focuses on when I was a teenager and I worked for Kentucky Fried Chicken. I had recognized over my many years of reading as an editor that I just didn't see a lot of work about work, and certainly not about fast food work. It became interesting to me because I thought, well, this is such a formative period in your life, and so many people end up working in these environments, and yet, in the end, we kind of put them aside as something from adolescence, childhood, that really we don't think as that formative. And I'd been telling stories to my wife, Allison Joseph, who's also a poet and editor, for years, and she kept saying, "You've got to write these down." And so I finally started writing them down. And it's become a complete collection of work that I'm hoping to finish within this year and see what it amounts to. But definitely that has been an obsession. But the thing, like I said, the thing about the fast food work poems is that I realized how, in some ways, how brutal the work situation was. And yet, of course, I mean, when you're 16, 17 years old, you don't think about it. It's what you're doing, and you're kind of trusting that everything's going to be okay and that you'll heal up and all of that. But it was really tough physical work with a lot of opportunities for people to hurt themselves and in some pretty devastating ways, and yet you just kind of went on making your, well, at the time that I worked, the minimum wage I think was at one point $1.90 an hour. So
wow.
And I started out making sub minimum wage because when I first got the job I was 15, so I was being paid $1.65 an hour. No matter how much you work, it's not going to amount to much. So that was something else about it that I found, that once I started working and started getting a paycheck, I started to try to work more and more and more to make it amount to something.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is true. I mean, I really can't think of anyone else that's been writing about this particular, you know, part of our culture, part of our experience. That you know, it is true that so many people end up working retail or fast food, you know, at the beginning of their years as a member of the workforce. You know, they start off in high school, like you said, or maybe just out of high school, and yet those things deeply inform our relationship with authority, our relationship with money, and our relationship with who we work with and what we think of the world of commerce and the world of the interaction between a customer and a person in a position, whether as a cashier or someone that's providing a service.
Oh, that's definitely true. And just in so many ways, you don't necessarily think of it as this, because of course you're probably thinking ahead to either what you're going to do, what you're planning to do as work going forward, or college, or some type of vocational training. But in the end, it really is your introduction to an adult world.
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter what, you're going to be working with people who this is their life. And whether it's, I mean, just the management that you work with, or, but I worked with not any other cooks. That was an interesting thing, that all of the cooks were kind of young men about the age I was at the time. Maybe one or two of them were edging toward 20, but no one in their 20s. But the managers, the assistant managers, and interestingly enough, some of the women working in the stores that I worked in were very definitely providing for their families. It always struck me as strange after the fact to think that none of the cooks, that was the case. But in terms of some of the women who worked the counters and were the kind of the face of the store in many ways for people coming in, they might be in their 30s or 40s. And again, they were definitely providing one of the incomes or the only income for their family, depending on their circumstances. So when you're 16 years old and you're in that situation, you start to realize that this is real. I mean, that it's not just a part-time job in some ways, because some of the people around you, this is their livelihood.
Yeah, it is kind of that wake-up call that this is not just, you know, pocket change that you're earning, but you're in a workspace with other people for whom this is the difference between whether or not they can feed a family. This is the difference mm-hmm. between whether or not they can, you know, afford to have a roof over their head for a little bit longer. Why do you think there's such a reluctance to write about this particular chapter of our work experience or our youth?
I don't know. I think that it really has become a fascinating thing for me to see that. Part of it is that I think there are subjects, certainly from the standpoint of American poetry, as much as it has opened up to a variety of subject matter that has gotten more and more expansive, there are still things that people look at and think, that's not going to be a poetic subject. That's not going to be something that's going to give you entrance into the kind of intellectual material, meditative material, lyric material that is going to make for poetry. That's been one of the biggest challenges of writing this work, is finding ways. It certainly would have been in many ways easier to have approached it as either nonfiction or fiction, because the language questions that come into play in terms of trying to find a way to write where figurative language, where the cadence and the rhythms of your phrasing is going to be something that feels like poetry to you, those questions wouldn't have been as pointed as in fiction or nonfiction prose as they were in poetry. And it was interesting. I mean, when I read a couple of poems, one of them's going to be one of the very first times I tried to write about this at all. Mm-hmm. And it's a poem that centers around just a simple activity we did every day, sometimes for an hour or two each day, and it was the act of breaking chicken, which was breaking it down to prepare it to cook. And to try to find a way to write a poem about that was very interesting, because it required me to really both think back at how it physically felt to do this, and then to think about what was it like, and what did it remind me of? What was the kind of sense memory that I was left with? Other poems, when I've written them that are more narrative poems that explore either situations that came about during during the work, or people that I came to know, and kind of their stories as well, that finding within those and the possibilities of trying to see the store, trying to see the work itself, trying to see the imaginative possibilities and make poems out of those. As I did more and more of that, that became a little easier after a while. But at first, I would sketch out things where I knew what I would be writing about, but I really wouldn't know where a poem would take that, and that became the really interesting thing, that to see where approaching this as poetry would make it something different than approaching it as simply an exploration of the events or the people or the place or the time.
Yeah, a lot of this conversation is resonating with me because of the work I was doing on my second book that had to do with, I was writing about the computer programming field, you know, the world mm-hmm. of computers, modern technology, computer science, and programming, and again, subject matter that often we don't think of as being sort of the field from which we would be writing poetry, but there was this transition period where I had to figure out, you know, how to tackle it. So it didn't feel like it was a superficial treatment,
mm-hmm.
but instead really engaged whatever was the experience of being there doing that type of work and how it became a lens with which I saw the rest of the world.
No, the kind of subject matter that would involve, I remember, and this would now be longer than I'd like to think, but years ago, over 25 years ago, when I was teaching at Indiana University as a graduate student, I actually team taught a course in poetry, science, and technology, and so we were seeing work that involved a subject matter that often poets don't visit, and it was fascinating to see how, and of course at that time, in many ways the ways that technology has become so ubiquitous in our lives now, it wasn't quite that at that back in the early 1990s, late 1980s, and yet it was right there on the cusp of becoming that.
Mm-hmm.
And people were starting to try to find ways to write about issues of technology that were so new. Of course, technology always kind of finds a way to refresh itself constantly, but that was a really eye-opening course to both structure and then teach and see how the students took to the different things that we introduced to them and what they would write themselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting too that I guess when I think about poetry, about work, I go back to Philip Levine as being mm-hmm. sort of like, for me at least, that was the first contemporary poet I read whose work really spoke to me, that I got it. You know, I think I had grown up working a whole host of different types of jobs, and some of them quite labor intensive, you know, a summer spent out in the fields on a farm pulling like Russian thistle from the ditches in like mm-hmm. 100 degree weather, or working in parking towers as a parking attendant, you know. And then later in life, find myself, you know, when I was a programmer, working in cubicles and offices far, far distant from the earth and from physical sweat, and yet still feeling a different type of exhaustion.
Oh yes, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that that whether work is physical or primarily work that its demands are mostly upon your mind. I mean, there's just different ways to be exhausted, but getting to that point, I mean, is a truth that all work can bring you to. And there was, of course, I mean, most of the Kentucky Fried Chicken work was physically exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
So much of that, and of course, the conditions could be really pretty terrible. There was a point when I remember working in a kitchen that the health department had to shut down because they came in and measured the temperature in the kitchen at 140 degrees. And so they closed us down until they fixed all the ventilation and cooling in it, because I mean, the air conditioning had gone off and we had like one or two little fans trying to keep us cool. So what we would do to try to combat that is we'd walk into the walk-in freezer and freeze our clothes on us. So, I mean, that way for the next 45 minutes or so, you would actually be cool. But that's not a good solution. So, as the health department realized.
So when you look over, you know, what's out there today in terms of contemporary poetry, are there poets that write about work that you do find this type of connection to, that you feel are engaged in writing about work in an interesting and compelling way?
Well, I mean, one person that definitely has taken on the kind of that kind of modern office work that was really fascinating was Victoria Chang's The Boss.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I mean, that from that standpoint, I mean, she did some really nice things and kind of turned a lot of that idea of power relationships and offices on its head. So someone else who I think I've looked at as for more the kind of work that that I'm writing about in terms of the Kentucky Fried Chicken stuff is David Dominguez.
Mm-hmm.
He's done some real explorations of kind of the physical labor that can drive you to exhaustion and the people who do that work. And I guess that also has factored into the fast food poems for me, is that I've always wanted to make sure that the poems I'm writing are poems that if I read them to the people I worked with, they'd make sense.
Mm.
That they would speak to, I mean, not just my experience, but their experiences as well. And so I've kept them. I've made sure that they don't disappear into the ether somehow, and that they stay very grounded in the realities of the work as I can remember it, and particularly. Because of that, I guess there's a lot of of injury that enters into the book. There's a lot that really focuses on the things you do remember clearly that were about either you or other people getting hurt, and so that's certainly a part of it. The other thing that I've done a bit of is a lot of research on Colonel Sanders, and at times kind of trying to write some things that explore the way that there's a kind of myth-making to American business. And I wanted that to enter in. It was so much a part of the kind of ethos of the company about this. And it was true. I mean, this wasn't Ronald McDonald. This was an actual man who, at the time I worked for Kentucky Fried Chicken, was still alive. There was one time that I actually spent a day trying to keep a store running, but as spotless as possible, because we thought he was going to come visit. And so we had been put into a particular store for the day, myself and then some other people that were drawn out of other stores in the Little Rock area franchises, that I guess we were picked because we were supposed to be the best cooks and employees that they had, and we were all put into one little store that was a lot more like the old-fashioned kind of pickup window stores that they had started the business at. And they thought he was in Little Rock for the day, and there was talk that he, if he had time, he was going to visit this store. And so we spent the day trying to be ready for him. And that was kind of a weird thing. The other thing that was a strange coincidence in terms of just when I quit working for them, within the next month or so, he died. And so I still, of course, I mean, even though I'd quit, I knew a lot of the people working there, and so I got to see fairly close at hand the company mourn his passing, and how they went about that, and how having this figure, this kind of icon who wasn't just for advertising but was so much for advertising at the same time, become kind of move from being a real person to a kind of myth and image to now just something that they have actors dress up as. I don't know what he would have thought of people imitating him. I don't think he would have liked it. So.
Well, I mean, listening to you talk about it, it is fascinating because it sounds awfully messianic, you know, in terms of like waiting for him to come, keeping the space spotless, mm-hmm. and yet everyone running as best as they can, and then the sort of this tremendous loss, you know, this mourning that happens with his passing, and then trying to keep him alive again. I'm certain this is all coming out in the poems because it sounds like it's already there.
Oh, yes, definitely. That there are different ones that deal more, that really focus on aspects of how he intersected with the work that we were doing. And it was fascinating because the very first day I went to work, they had me sit down and watch a training video that began with him at the site of his first store and telling you all about, I mean, it wasn't really telling you about doing the work. It was just telling you about his story that had made this company. And yet, by that point, I mean, he was so far from having anything to do except showing up in occasionally opening stores. But that didn't matter. It was still this idea that here was this man who in his 60s had decided to give this idea of franchising restaurants a shot. And so that was where they started you out. So it was very much this sort of so much the story of his life was supposed to, I guess, inspire you in some way, but you were going, but okay, when are we going to get to how we cook chicken?
You're listening to The Lit Fantastic on KBOO Community Radio. You can find previous episodes on iTunes or thelitfantastic.com. Now back to our conversation with poet and editor John Tribble.
I'm now really, really excited about reading this book. I mean, I was interested before, but now I'm really, really interested. The other thing that kind of I wonder about, too, is what have been some of the biggest surprises for you, whether in terms of the research that you've done or in terms of the writing and, you know, contemplating of this material as you revisit it, you know, later on in life?
Well, there'd be kind of two different things. There was the, I mean, as I researched him, his life, and I was really surprised by the ways in which, just coincidentally, my life and my family background really intersected with him. Because, I mean, though, of course, I mean, everyone thinks of him in terms of Kentucky, and truly, I mean, he started the first place where he was selling this chicken as a gas station in Corbin, Kentucky, and I finally went to the spot where they have reconstructed part of something that's supposed to look like his original store that he was selling the chicken in, but they've also got attached an actual functioning store right next to it. So it's a very odd move from the, you walk into the present and move to the past, and so that's an odd thing. But no, I found out, I mean, one, he practiced law in Little Rock, Arkansas, where I'm from. He set up his first family in Tuscumbia, Alabama, where my grandmother lived. I mean, there are just all these weird little intersections of his story and and places I know very well. He was actually from southern Indiana, where I spent 5 years in graduate school. So it was just finding out those things in his life really struck me as, okay, this is particularly, I think, when I found out that he had spent time doing, he wasn't an actual lawyer. He did what they used to call, he read the law, so that he could show up in justice of the peace courts and argue for clients. But that ended very badly for him, because he actually took a cane and beat one of his clients in court. One of his own clients, so, because he thought the guy was ripping him off. So he was barred from the justice of the peace courts in Arkansas after that. But no, so there was that aspect to it. What I knew, and it may have been why I had avoided writing some of the things about it as well, I knew that there was, at the heart of the work, there was a lot of physical pain. Mm-hmm. And I knew that at least for some of the poems, to be honest and true, I had to get back to what that really meant. And there are poems in the book that were pretty excruciating to write, because I had to remember what that kind of pain felt like. And that was not a welcome thing, but I knew that it was something that I had to do if I was going to really write this collection. I couldn't avoid that ultimately. And so when I started out writing, like I said, the very first poem and some of the other poems were sense memories about the place or about the work or about a certain activity. But I did know that kind of lurking behind that was some pretty painful stuff that just, I'd have to see where the poems would take me and be willing to really try to remember those things as fully as I could.
Did you find also in the process that you remembered or discovered things that were unexpectedly beautiful or moving?
Occasionally, and certainly at least, if not beautiful, kind of strangely fascinating. That in terms of trying to find some figurative language at times to speak to a very, what you start off with thinking of as a very kind of hands-on but ordinary type of activity for you, because you're doing it, you start to realize, saying that there are some things that are oddly beautiful, oddly strange connections you had never thought about making, that as you write and enter into those possibilities and memories again, you find that that those can be a really rich thing to discover in the poems. And again, in the, I was just remembering one of the things from my research about Colonel Sanders. I actually discovered that he made a bossa nova album. So it was, again, I mean, the number of ways that at his peak as a celebrity, I guess, is the best way to think of it. But the number of ways they tried to monetize him is fascinating. I mean, this album, which was basically a knockoff of the Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, and probably used some of the same studio musicians. So, but it was clearly a ripoff of their success, and it was called Colonel Sanders' Tijuana Picnic. And I mean, you can't make this stuff up. There are so many things that I haven't written about that I came across in the research that I did, because they predated my experiences with the work that, in terms of time, but in the late 60s, before, I mean, when I would have been about 5 or 6 or 7, I mean, the ads they put out on television for Kentucky Fried Chicken were just insane. There's actually one that they showed on American television that had a woman dressed up in a flesh-colored bodysuit pretending to be Lady Godiva riding around the countryside giving out fried chicken. I mean, I don't know what I would do with that in a poem, and since I do not remember seeing it, and I think if I'd seen it, I'd remember it. They really at times did some crazy stuff. So, and at one point, of course, she rides up to Colonel Sanders and hands him a piece of chicken. So, yeah.
Wow, that, I would not have known that. And you're right, you cannot make up these things. They're just too incredible.
You definitely don't have to. The Tijuana Picnic, though, does enter into one of my poems. So because of into, I think, the poem that's about waiting on Colonel Sanders, waiting that day, because since the type of store that he was pushing when they were, the other reason for the Tijuana Picnic album, at least for the album notes, was they had opened their first store in Mexico. And so the album notes on the back of it, where he talks about each song and pushes fried chicken and talks about moving into Mexico with his businesses, that type of store was the type we were working that day. So it gave me an opening to bring that up, and it was just too good to pass up.
That definitely sounds too good to pass up. So before we close up, I was wondering if you would mind reading a couple poems, one or two poems for us.
Sure, sure. And I thought that what might be interesting, there are two poems that over the years I've published in the magazine Southern Indiana Review, and one was the very first of the fried chicken poems I published back in 2006, and the other is one from last year. So I thought I'd read both of those, because one is more the lyric kind of sense memory, and the other is more a story type, a bit of a narrative. So the first one is titled Breaking Bird. You break the thighs, that's all. A quick snap like you imagine any bone forced from the joint it's bedded in might give to pull and twist and pop. The raw meat under your fingers cool to the touch like water in the shade of a cliff face that never feels the sun, like moss on the underside of a deadfall off a quiet path. The skin thick like the tongue of a work boot. Nothing like anything once alive should feel. Sliding and sucking in the tightening grip of your thumb. But that is last. First, there is the tail. Nub of useless stump that feathered the fat and bony end of these inept flyers. And you crank it once, twice, mostly never three times, till it gives way in your pinch, and you toss it off into the growing pile in the trash where these clips of skin and bone collect, each looking like the first joint of a fleshy thumb that's lost its nail, naked now, unable to grasp even the smallest thing. So that was, as I said, that was a poem from 2006, so almost a decade, or now a decade ago. This was a poem that was published just last year and tells a bit more of a story. It's titled Wishbone. A handshake with pain under the palm's fleshy bunker, sandbagging muscle and nerve below the soft knot, swollen with heat in a hot summer of breading and frying, frying and breading, and so much soapy water in sinks and buckets that the spongy wrinkled skin, like the dead bird's skin, feels right feeling wrong. And so it's only when your hand begins to look like a blued fillet, scars marking sears from grease and flame, and your fingers have fattened like plumping franks on the end of a campfire skewer, you begin rubbing the delta of the thumb and index finger, the nexus of the pain you have ignored for a week, week and a half at most, and you feel a thin bone where there is no bone, no bone of yours at least, a needle stitching its way inside the tight knitting of your muscle and blood, and you keep massaging its line of nerve fire until you find the tender point of this inch-long splinter, and against the tongue-biting, eye-searing scream of each measure of renewed press and push, a point finally breaks back out of what you imagined was your closed skin. An old wound open. You thought nothing more than a scratch, when a chicken bone from the keel, the center breast cut from beneath the bird's tender rib cage, knifed so quietly inside, curving within the pocket hiding under your thumb until infection protested this invasion, burning out what never belonged in, and you slowly pull on the end, hoping it will all hold together, and through the pus and blood it does. And when you wash it clean, your hand cleansed over and over in steamy lather and soaking in a bowl full of alcohol until all the heat is gone, you realize you hold in your other hand the short end of a wishbone, a failure like so many you don't see yet ahead. Now only a curiosity and caution that won't slow you down soon enough.
Well, thank you. Those were incredible.
It is a manuscript. I really have no idea whether people will respond well to it or not. I can certainly understand, again, that feeling that that some of this is pretty rough material and not necessarily what people think first of when they're thinking of reading poetry. So I'm certainly understanding of the possibilities that it might catch on very well. It might take a while. So there's definitely that feeling of hopeful of hopeful optimism that the book will stand up. I tentatively have a title for it that's based on an interesting poem in the book called God of the Kitchen, where I imagine kind of a fever dream sort of thing where a actual kind of God rises out of the fryers remaking the chicken like it's a kind of Aztec thing and sacrifices all of us. So it has certainly some flights of imagination within it, but also in some of the history of the company, some of the history I had in terms of working in it. So I'm hoping it'll all fall together in a good way.
It sounds like the individual poems are finding publication.
They are. I've already, even as new as a lot of the work is, because like I said, I started the project in a serious way as far as thinking of it as that, probably in the spring of 2014, and so it hasn't been that long to have written. I think now almost 35 poems along this line, and some of them quite long. So some of the narratives are definitely longer poems. Probably two-thirds of that work has already been published, either published or accepted. So I'm happy about that.
Yeah, congratulations! And
thank you.
Yeah, I think like that's usually a good sign if a substantial portion of the manuscript is those poems are finding homes. Something's resonating with the readers out there.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And one of the other things I did with this book is that it has some pretty interesting, inventive things in terms of form as well, because I mean, that was one of the things that for me became a real driving force of trying to find some poetic structure in terms of some of the material I was writing about. My favorite is a poem that is sort of like an acrostic in that it, if you read the first word down the lines, you actually have the words of a Kentucky Fried Chicken jingle. So that was fun to do and a challenge because they started at the end of the jingle repeating the word nice, and nice is not an easy word to repeat.
Yeah, nice is not nice for poets.
Not nice when you're writing. So I only used the refrain once, because the refrain, I think, had nice in it three times, and I said, I can't keep doing this.
Well, it's been an absolute delight to talk to you today and to hear more about your obsessions, and specifically about this, how they feed into this particular book.
I have enjoyed it as well. It's been really great talking with you and getting a chance to talk about these poems.
Well, thank you once more, hope to hear more about your upcoming projects in the near future.
Well, thank you, and again, it's been a delight having this conversation.
That was poet and editor John Tribble, author of Natural State and There Is Many a Good Thing, as well as the forthcoming God of the Kitchen. We'll be back again next month at the same time. Until then, you can check out previous episodes on iTunes or thelitfantastic.com. And if you haven't figured it out by now, you're listening to the music from Tijuana Picnic. Until next month, this has been your host, Neil Aiken.
Hey, Lit Fantastic listeners, producer and editor Jenna here, bringing you an Easter egg for sitting through that last song in the end credits there. In case you're curious, that's the opening track from Tijuana Picnic titled Taste of Honey. So while I was editing this episode, I couldn't help but listen to the entire Tijuana Picnic album, which is surprisingly good and does sound exactly like Herb Alpert's Tijuana Brass. Of course, this sent me down the KFC rabbit hole, where I found that Lady Godiva commercial.
Kentucky Fried Chicken tastes great, and it's convenient. Lady Godiva didn't stop to fix dinner. Why should you? You make history. Let Colonel Sanders make dinner.
And in case that wasn't enough for you, they also did a Cleopatra.
Who's got time to make dinner when you're busy making history? Kentucky Fried Chicken tastes great, and it's convenient. Cleopatra didn't stop to fix dinner. Why should you? You make history. Let Colonel Sanders make dinner.
And a Paul Revere commercial, too.
The chickens are coming! The chickens are coming! The chickens are coming!
Who's got time to make dinner when you're busy making history? Colonel Sanders' Kentucky Fried Chicken tastes great, and it's so convenient you can get it right in your neighborhood. They didn't stop to fix dinner. Why should you? You make history. We'll make dinner. Colonel Sanders already made history by fixing Sunday dinner 7 days a week. and it's finger-licking good.
Ah, is there anything more American than KFC? Well, thanks for tuning in to another episode of The Lit Fantastic. Make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and follow us on Facebook at The Lit Fantastic. You can also find out more information about all of our episodes on thelitfantastic.com. That was the LitFantastic.com premiere here, the Lit Fantastic premiere here on KBOO Community Radio with Neil Akin. Coming up next is the UBU Hour, but before that, here is some insight from Insight Daily talking about Maya Angelou's new hip-hop collaboration.
Insight Daily Radio.
Pink and beige and purple, tan and blue and white. I've sailed upon
before her passing at age 86, renowned poet, author, dancer, actress, and singer, Dr. Maya Angelou signed off on a unique 7-year album project. Entitled Caged Bird Songs, the release skillfully pairs the legendary poet's illuminating commentary about life and social issues with a contemporary fusion of hip-hop, R&B, blues, and jazz. We spoke with producer Sean Rivera about this unique musical project.
We laugh and moan in Guinea and thrive on Spanish shores. We seek success in Finland, are born.
She's very adamant about making sure that the music would reach younger people. She was wanted to make sure that it was respectful of her message. I thought that Maya would be more like an old stalwart trying to hold on to the way music used to be back in the bebop era. Maya really wanted to reach out to the hip-hop generation and, you know, continue what the work that she was already a part of with Common. And, you know, she reached out to the hip-hop community with Tupac, and on BET and other formats. So this wouldn't be her first introduction to hip hop, but it's the public's first introduction to her as a hip hop artist, which I think they'll be pleasantly surprised.
Purple, tan, and blue and white. I've sailed upon the seven seas and stopped in every land. I've seen the wonders of the world, not yet one common man. I know 10,000 women called Jane.
That's producer Sean Rivera on the album Caged Bird Songs, the posthumous release of the late Dr. Maya Angelou. There's more online, insightdailyradio.org.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of the film Pinkwashing Exposed, Seattle Fights Back, Friday, February 9th, 7 p.m. at the Fifth Avenue Cinema in Portland. Pinkwashing Exposed, Seattle Fights Back tells the story of queer Palestinian solidarity activists. They successfully lobbied the city of Seattle's LGBT commission to drop an Israeli government-supported tour featuring gay and lesbian activists. The film sheds light on what pinkwashing is, how local activists are fighting back, and the resulting community backlash. Again, that's Pinkwashing Exposed, Seattle Fights Back on Friday, February 9th, 7 p.m. at the Fifth Avenue Cinema, 510 Southwest Hall Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 5th Annual Clinton Street Fat Tuesday Celebration on Tuesday, February 13th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. The Clinton Street Fat Tuesday Celebration includes screenings of the films Dry Wood and Always for Pleasure, two documentary portraits by Les Blank on Louisiana life and Mardi Gras culture. There will also be food and music. Again, that's the 5th Annual Clinton Street Fat Tuesday Celebration on Tuesday, February 13th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you.
Help us help you keep Portland weird. Join Contessa de la Luna of the World Famous Confessional for the 6th annual Contessa de la Luna Valentine's Spectacular and Fashion Show. We're giving away a $100 cash prize plus live performances by Contessa de la Luna. Get your weird on and bring a date. Advance tickets available at Brown Paper Tickets. Community radio station, KBOO. That's Thursday, February 15th, 7 to 9:45 p.m. Feel the love of your other Contessa de la Lunatics. Contessa de la Luna's Valentine's Spectacular, Thursday, February 15th at the Clinton Street Theater, 7 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland. You are tuned to the Ubu Hour. Tonight, we present an encore presentation of the radio drama Dotard vs. Rocket Man, which we aired near the end of last year. The show that originally aired suffered from several programming malfunctions and other questionable gaffes. The programming malfunctions have been eliminated so that you can now enjoy the program as it originally should have aired in 2017. We have also bleeped out any offensive material that should not have been aired when the program originally aired.